It's a great pleasure to welcome you to another episode of Across the Pond, where we discuss the big stories and top investment ideas from the Eurozone and Switzerland. The US was not only the birthplace of private markets, it remains the dominant global hub for the asset class, accounting for over half of the funds raised from investors globally. That makes it more than twice as large as the second biggest market, Europe. But private equity in Europe has been developing fast despite recent global headwinds from economic uncertainty. While Europe has lagged the US in some of the major tech innovations in recent years, notably AI, there are still plenty of opportunities in private equity on the continent. I'm Christopher Swan.
And I'm Belinda Peters. Given the importance of the US market in understanding European perspectives, we are delighted to be joined by our special guest, Viral Patel, CEO of Blackstone Private Equity Strategies, who can provide a global overview of private equity. Blackstone was among the pioneers in private equity, now with four decades of investment experience. We are also joined by our own esteemed colleague, Antoinette Zuidweg, CIO Alternatives Investment Strategist. In today's discussion, we will discuss what is driving more economic activity away from public markets. Is the 60-40 portfolio dead? And where are the best neighborhoods in the European market? Thank you for joining us both.
Thanks so much for having us.
So maybe we can start with the global perspective. As Belinda was mentioning, we are seeing an increasing share of economic activity occurring outside publicly traded markets. Perhaps you can give us some sense of what's driving that shift and how is it impacting the private equity landscape globally?
Well, thank you. And to start with, the factors that are driving this shift from that are impacting the private equity landscape include this greater access to private capital and this access to flexible financing. So companies no longer necessarily need public markets to raise funds. Private capital markets are offering the scale and the expertise and particularly the patient capital that once required a public listing. And then second of all, private managers now really play a pivotal role in funding companies and are actually driving value creation, supporting the development of the real economy with fewer and fewer new listings and more companies staying private for longer or choosing to stay private for longer and really also in many cases benefiting from the access and from the active approach from private equity managers to gain exposure to high growth, innovative businesses through public markets alone is becoming increasingly difficult for investors. And this, of course, makes it then essential for investors to include also their exposure to or increase their exposure to private assets in their portfolio and particularly to avoid missing out of any opportunities and access to key sectors of the economy. So as I mentioned, this growth and this innovation and this diversification opportunities and also not unimportant, this increased return potential as well that investors are looking for is now mostly happening on the private markets before companies ever reach the public markets at all. So this represents really this value transfer from the public markets to private market investors. And we can think of this also looking at this historically, where since the early 2000s, the number of listed companies on the US markets have halved, while more and more companies are staying private for longer. Companies are taking about twice as long to IPO. And importantly, if we're looking at the top five current private companies, these are on average valued at over 250 billion and also over 25 times larger than the top five current public listed companies at their time of IPO. So this also really underlines also this importance of looking at gaining access to private market opportunities beyond public alone.
And Viral, staying on the global theme, you recently wrote a piece on rethinking the traditional 60-40 portfolio. Maybe you could walk us through why private clients are looking beyond the 60-40 public equity and bond allocation. And can you maybe also explain to us the role of private equity in today's portfolio?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Thank you for asking. You know, it's interesting when you think about the formation of the capital markets over the last 20 to 25 years, you've seen a little bit of a divergence in how institutional investors build their portfolios versus how individual investors have done it, right? So the individual investor has focused on this traditional 60-40 portfolio with 60% public equities driving growth and then 40% fixed income for income and diversification. And institutional investors really have not taken that approach. They've taken a little bit more of a holistic approach, incorporating private markets into their asset allocation. And so if you look at our institutional investors, right? So if you look at our pension plans, the sovereign wealth funds that invest with Blackstone, you'll often find that 20 to 30% of their entire portfolio can be allocated to private markets. And if you speak to some of the families or the endowments that we work with, oftentimes you'll find that they will push 50, 60% into private markets. Now, if you look at the private wealth market, you know, that we think is less than 1% penetrated. And, you know, part of the reason for that has been, liquidity constraints about getting access to the market, and that's certainly changing. But if you speak to our institutions and ask them, well, why have you incorporated all of this private market exposure? Why not stick to the 60-40? You typically hear two things, right? One, you hear diversification. You know, Antoinette just mentioned in the public markets how concentrated things have become. In the private markets, you get a much broader array of investment opportunities to invest behind. I think one thing that people forget is that most of the global economy actually happens in the private markets, right? So if you look at scaled companies, so let's just take companies north of $250 million in revenue, nearly 90% of those businesses are private, not public. So if you're trying to build a diversified equity portfolio and you just do it in public markets, well, you're just diversifying in like 10% of the global economy. So if you want exposure to the global economy, you have to have some private market exposure. And you can debate how much is appropriate for you based on your risk tolerance, but there should be some amount, or liquidity tolerance, rather. There should be some amount. And then the other piece, as Antoinette mentioned, is returns, right? So if you look over the last 25 years, at least for private equity has outperformed public markets on an industry-wide basis by about 400 basis points, right? And if you think about 400 basis points compounding over a 25-year period, that's a lot of excess return. And so institutions have seen this for a long time over the last few decades and have really started to increase their exposure. And I think we're now in the early innings of individual investors starting to understand the benefits that this asset class provides and increasing it. So we do think that less than 1% penetration that we talked about in the coming years is going to increase dramatically.
And to follow up on that, if we look at our own research and what it would look like to add private equity and the reasons to add private equity and other private assets to a portfolio, we've mentioned the diversification, we've mentioned better risk-adjusted returns, but not unimportant is also the lower sensitivity to market noise. Private markets are typically less affected by short-term volatility, news flows, market inefficiencies, and this also allows companies to really focus on long-term value creation. This broader access to growth, as Ross just mentioned before, and also the superior long-term performance. So also, if we look at the past 10 years, what we have observed, we see that private equity has delivered approximately 14% of annualized returns, and we can compare this to about 8% for public markets. Then if we look at this from an allocation perspective, then at UBS we think that up to 20% of an allocation of private equity could fit in an equity portfolio for most investors who, of course, also have the correct tolerance for illiquidity and a long-term time horizon to do so.
Yeah, you both mentioned the superior performance that you've seen from private equity over recent decades, but obviously the industry has faced some sort of headwinds and challenges in recent years. What makes private equity still a compelling investment opportunity in today's environment?
Yeah. So look, I think there certainly have been, you know, no shortage of, I'd say, headlines around private equity and some of the headwinds that that have been in the market. I will tell you the data that we see right now is a little bit more encouraging and a bit more optimistic in terms of where we think the market is. I think you start with the general concept that we are seeing both in the a little bit more in the U.S. but than in Europe, but certainly globally, you're continuing to see economic growth throughout the economies, right? So the economies have been more resilient than you'd expect. So we're seeing continued growth across our businesses. We're seeing global inflation coming down to more tolerable levels, and we're seeing the cost of capital decrease. So anytime you have, you know, macroeconomic factors like that all together, that generally results in a pretty attractive environment to be putting capital to work. And if you think about what private equity is very good at doing, and, you know, Antoinette just mentioned this, you know, we're not passive investors in companies. When we buy a company, it's with the purpose of transforming it. It's with the purpose of adding value and building it into something bigger. And when you can have an environment that has the supportive macro that I just mentioned, and you can bring resources to bear to be able to drive our businesses and transform them, it creates a really amazing environment for us to be able to generate returns. And you're starting to see that, frankly, even in deal activity. So if you look at our internal activity, our deal teams, you know, we look at NDAs signed as a leading indicator of activity, and that's up over 2 times relative to the start of this year, right? And so we're seeing a tremendous amount of opportunities globally come to market and giving us a tremendous amount of opportunity to put capital to work in ways that are very diversifying and complementary to what you can get in the public markets right now.
So, I mean, this series is called Across the Pond, partly because we focus on Europe. And obviously, private equity has historically been really quite heavily concentrated in North America. But Europe has been gaining quite a lot of ground, right? And now accounts for roughly 40% of deals so far in 2025. What factors do you see as driving this shift?
So if we are looking at Europe, then European private equity has also accelerated in 2025. And we see reasons for this being the regional inflation, so the Eurozone inflation actually approaching central bank targets. And also the European central banks have already advanced further in their rate cutting cycle or are already on hold as the ECB right now. And this also, what we see next to this as well, is also valuations in Europe have generally trailed those in the US, presenting more attractive entry points compared to US opportunities. So if we look at this over the long term, then European performance is also quite attractive and in for those top managers as well, on par with the US, even if we do see a bit of a wider dispersion there, if we look at the performance-wise. And there's also, of course, more complexity in this region to consider. Another point that has been driving also some increased interest in the region comes from fiscal stimulus and targeted investment incentives that we're seeing, particularly around energy and themes like defense and digital technologies, but also infrastructure. And other areas that we see contributing, these are also other areas that we see contributing to a dynamic investment environment. And a final point that I would like to add to that is also of interest is that we see more US investors showing increased interest in the European private equity space. And what we have noticed is that so far in 2025, we see of all we see more US investor involvement in European deals, and US investors have provided near 40% of capital for European deals. So that is something that I would like to give back with that.
And Verwal, I'm also curious to hear your opinion on how European PE has evolved. And do you see any common threats with the US and how investors should be thinking about their exposures?
Yeah, look, I think Antoinette provided a good macro perspective on Europe. And certainly we share the view that valuations in Europe are relatively cheaper than they are in the U.S. right now. Part of that can be explained by slightly slower economic growth. But even accounting for that, we do think valuations for European companies in the private markets right now represent an interesting entry point for investors. You know, when you really think about what's happening in the interest rate cuts that, you know, the ECB and the Bank of England have started doing, and those certainly started happening sooner than the U.S., you've seen that deal pickup that I talked about in Europe as well as the U.S. In the last quarter, actually, deal values are up 25% quarter over quarter. That's the fastest increase that we've seen in at least over a year. And they're on track to actually increase 10% year over year. So this is going to be one of the strongest years for European private equity that we've had in some time. And, you know, I mentioned that nearly 90% stat of companies being private. In Europe, that percentage is actually even higher. So the investable universe for private markets for European investors is actually even more than it is in the U.S. So we continue to think there's interesting opportunities in the private markets. There's also interesting opportunities to take companies private from the public markets in Europe. So in late 2023, we acquired Adevinta, which is an online classified business that was one of Europe's largest buyouts that year. And so we continue to see opportunities both directly into private markets to take companies out of the public markets into the private markets.
So maybe you can drill down just a tiny bit more into sector specifics. You've mentioned this intriguing concept of good neighborhoods before. And perhaps you can just explain what you mean by that term and highlight some of the good neighborhoods that you're focusing on at the moment.
Yeah, look, good neighborhoods is one of those things that you just use internally to help focus the team's like time and thoughts. And what we mean by that is we'd like to have our investments tied to themes that are long-term, durable, secular growth sectors, right? And so where are the big changes in the economy happening, and try to make investments by companies that are tied to those big themes. And part of the reason for that is if you can tie your investments to those sorts of durable growth areas, they can be slightly a bit more defensive even if you go through macroeconomic cycles, right? Growing sectors make it much easier if companies have a misstep here and there to be able to continue with your investment thesis. Much harder to do, it's not like you can't do it, but harder to do when you have a stagnant sector or a sector that's declining. So we do spend a significant amount of time at the firm, really all of us, looking at the data and the signal that we're seeing from the $1.3 trillion of assets that we manage to figure out where are those good neighborhoods today, and then more importantly, where are they going to be tomorrow, so we can continue to stay ahead of that. So today, as we think about globally, one of the things that we're most excited about is power demand, actually, both in the U.S. And in Europe. You know, in the U.S. specifically, you know, the U.S. has been flat power demand for about 20, 25 years now. So any gains that we've needed have been offset by efficiency. This year, it was up about 2 to 3%, and we expect it to be up 40%. In the next decade, and we actually don't have enough generating capacity to meet that. The reason for that, for this increase, is, you know, the data center growth that's happening globally is really power consumptive. That requires a huge amount of energy. The U.S. in particular is reshoring manufacturing, and then you have, you know, globally as a society, right? We're electrifying everything, like, you know, cars. My daughter's now got 3 devices, and so, you know, all of that creates tremendous amounts of strain on the system. And so, you know, we think there's going to be a super cycle of CapEx investments that are going to happen globally around energy. And so as a firm, we tend to think about that as to how can we play that. So our infrastructure businesses and our energy businesses are actually buying generation, transmission, utilities. Our private equity businesses are looking at that and saying, what are the service providers to that economy that are going to happen? Let's buy businesses that are going to be tied to that. So that power demand theme is really a good neighborhood globally that we think is going to be very attractive. We're also, as an institution, spending a lot of time on franchisor business models, right? So these are, you know, fast-growing trophy franchise brands where we can bring our institutional value-add capabilities to drive. I mean, these are businesses where someone else is opening a store, and we, as the brand owner, are getting a royalty, right? And so when you do it that way, we're not hiring the people, we're not spending the CapEx. And so you have high growth, high margin, high free cash flow. Those are all really fun words for a private equity investor. And so most recently, we bought a company called Jersey Mike's, which we're now expanding internationally. Into Europe, actually. So that's going to be coming to Europe soon. So please eat our sandwiches. So that business model is one that we think can be quite durable if you find the right concept. And then it's hard to talk about, you know, good neighborhoods and themes without saying the word AI. I feel like that's almost obligatory these days. But we are trying to really invest across the AI value chain, everything from the data center side, compute, processors, high-speed storage, up and down that chain. So that's kind of how we're thinking about our good neighborhoods.
So, you know, as you mentioned before, the U.S. has clearly been at the epicenter of AI innovation, with China also playing a leading role. But where do you see the most compelling AI opportunities, and how would you approach investing in AI given all the current hype around the sector?
For us, you know, for the last few years, we've really focused the AI investments around the picks and shovels of AI, really focusing on not trying to pick one winner in the space, but trying to say, if AI is going to be as transformative as we all think it is, then really spending time on data centers, spending time on the compute that's required to drive AI is an important place to invest. And one of the things that you see globally right now is that the hyperscalers are spending enormous amounts of capital to be able to bring AI to their consumers. You can't have AI without this infrastructure, and we are certainly doing it on a de-risked basis. We're trying to invest in data centers where we have long-term leases with investment grade counterparties kind of backing that infrastructure. So we continue to think that there's going to be a huge demand from high quality companies for capital to invest behind that. We've also recently started to move a little bit up the value chain into the application layer. So if you think over the last 20 to 30 years, you know, any technological wave that's come through, whether it's internet, mobile, or cloud, a significant amount of value has always been created at the application side, not just the infrastructure side. Now, the last 3-4 years, the applications in AI have been venture capital, so a little bit too early for us to invest. But as those companies mature, you'll see us kind of move a little bit further into the growth area and the application layer as well.
Maybe just to wrap it up here, and beyond AI, and perhaps you can handle this one, Antoinette, how should investors be thinking about positioning in private equity more broadly? I mean, in terms of particular sectors, particular strategies or themes, what do we find most compelling right now?
Yes, so to conclude on how we think about private equity more broadly, particularly being at the end of the year and looking forward into 2026, we think that if we look at where we are right now in the rate cycle, with central banks easing and fiscal policy really remaining pro-growth in the U.S., but also what we've discussed already, what we see in Europe as well, we do expect increased deal making, increased distributions and exits going forward. So we look at 2026 as a year where we're positive at the opportunities ahead. And this, of course, is supporting private equity returns to investors. And then again, in this world of lower rates, but also high public market valuations where we stand today, we do continue to focus, or we keep our focus on those managers who are able to spot value and really put their active management to work on value creation, look at value-oriented buyouts, complex carve-outs, for example, but also we look at secondaries as well. These are areas that we find attractive. And then finally, we also do recommend a bit of a regional diversification to look beyond the US alone, but also consider Europe and Asia to mitigate some regional risks. And outside of that, if we keep looking at the macroeconomic backdrop and the current favorable liquidity conditions, this should really help also the private equity managers to navigate elevated valuations, but also concentrated markets at the moment. Then if we look back at Europe, to leave the listeners with, we do like the following sectors. So asset light, margin high sectors, and think also of business services, technology, and also, as we mentioned before, areas related to energy and infrastructure, but also opportunities in healthcare and financial services.
Okay, thank you so much, both. And thanks to our listeners as well. We can't delve into specific securities on these podcasts, but you can explore some of these with your UBS representative. But just to quickly sum up, we believe European private equity may offer a powerful way to diversify away from US-centric portfolios, access new sources of return, and benefit from the region's unique value creation levers. We think the current environment, marked by attractive valuations, improving exits, and a supportive macro backdrop, makes this an opportune time to consider allocations, especially in growth buyout and the middle market. But as always, investors should be mindful of the illiquidity, complexity, and unique risks of investing in private equity.
Thanks, Belinda, and we'll be back for another installment of Across the Pond. In the meantime, have a great week.
UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the Global Wealth Management Business of UBS AG or its affiliates. The views and opinions expressed in this material by external guest speakers are those of the author, speaker, and are not those of UBS, its subsidiaries, or affiliates. Accordingly, UBS does not accept any liability over the content of this material or any claims, losses, or damages arising from the use or reliance of all or any part thereof. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient, and is published for informational purposes only. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.
Non-traditional asset classes are alternative investments that include hedge funds, private equity, private credit, real estate, and managed futures, collectively alternative investments. Interests of alternative investment funds are sold only to qualified investors and only by means of offering documents that include information about the risks, performance, and expenses of alternative investment funds, and which clients are urged to read carefully before subscribing and retain. An investment in an alternative investment fund is speculative and involves significant risks. Specifically, these investments, one, are not mutual funds and are not subject to the same regulatory requirements as mutual funds. Two, may have performance that is volatile, and investors may lose all or a substantial amount of their investment. Three, may engage in leverage and other speculative investment practices that may increase the risk of investment loss. Four, are long-term, illiquid investments. There is generally no secondary market for the interests of a fund, and none is expected to develop. Five, interests of alternative investment funds typically will be illiquid and subject to restrictions on transfer. Six, may not be required to provide periodic pricing or valuation information to investors. Seven, generally involve complex tax strategies, and there may be delays in distributing tax information to investors. Eight, are subject to high fees, including management fees and other fees and expenses, all of which will reduce profits. Interests in alternative investment funds are not deposits or obligations of or guaranteed or endorsed by any bank or other insured depository institution, and are not federally insured by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, the Federal Reserve Board, or any other government agency. Prospective investors should understand these risks and have the financial ability and willingness to accept them for an extended period of time before making an investment in an alternative investment fund, and should consider an alternative investment fund as a supplement to an overall investment program. In addition to the risks that apply to alternative investments generally, the following are additional risks related to an investment in private equity. Capital calls can be made on short notice, and the failure to meet capital calls can result in significant adverse consequences, including but not limited to a total loss of investment.